We were talking yesterday about the monastic viewpoint, and we didn't get as far into that as we could. I want to make it very clear at the outset that I'm not here trying to recruit anybody for the monastic way of life, although I do believe in a large portion of it, and I think there are ways that a great deal of it can be incorporated into non-monastic life. I'd like to start out with in the same way that I started yesterday. Well, yesterday I started out with a review. Today I won't start out with a review because I can't summarize what we did yesterday. So we'll start out fresh. And I'd like to tell another story, which I think says something. You'll have to tell me what it says. It's another one of these confusing stories. And if you don't mind the autobiographical dimension here, I'll simply say that this story is about something that happened to us when we were traveling, visiting monasteries. The setting for this one is middle December. Oh, let's see what year. I can't remember what year it was. 75, I think. And this was at the Gethsemane Abbey near Louisville, Kentucky. Everybody says near Louisville, but it's really by Bardstown, which is quite a ways out of Louisville. And I went there, well, Lois and I and children, as usual, went there because this was the home of Thomas Merton. And we were passing, driving across country just a week or so before Christmas, and we could swing down that way and visit the place, and I thought it'd be worthwhile to visit Gethsemane Abbey just to kind of look around a little bit. But because I was traveling with small children, and because it was the time of year when you can't really predict when you're going to arrive at a certain place because of, you know, blizzard conditions, I neglected to ride ahead. It's a good idea if you're going to visit any of these places to ride ahead and let them know. But we didn't do it on this occasion. And we drove up to the place. Again, I say middle of December, cold. You know, Californians always talk about the cold, the snow all around. We were drinking coffee and hot chocolate and came into this place, and I introduced us to the monk who answered the door. I'm told him why we were there. They were interested in Thomas Merton. And of course, there were, I don't know, 10 or 15 other people who were there that day who were interested in Thomas Merton, and they were kind of overrun with people who were interested in Thomas Merton. So that didn't do much. And I said, I just had one request. I said, I would really like, if I could, to meet Brother Patrick Hart. And Brother Patrick Hart was Merton's biographer. For 17 years, he was Merton's secretary. He was closer to Thomas Merton than during those 17 years than any other human being, I think. Although it could be that there are other people who, outside the monastery, who were closer friends of Merton's than the monks who were inside. Well, this man I was talking to, you know, when I said I would like to meet Brother Patrick Hart, this man held out his hand. And he said, "I'm Brother Patrick." So it turned out that the person that we had met at the door was the man that I had come there to meet, and that seemed rather propitious. Well, I asked him if he had a little time to talk about Merton, and he said he could take an hour. And I asked him questions. You know, Merton was involved in all kinds of things near the end of his life that are very difficult to interpret. There are hints that he wanted to move to Alaska to start in a monastery in Alaska. There are even suggestions that he was becoming a Buddhist, and that the reason he went to Asia, when he left San Francisco in 1968 to go to Asia, he wrote in his journal that at last, he said, "I am coming home." His life here in America was not at home, but the Asian environment was closer to home than what he had known before. So I had questions of that kind to ask Brother Patrick, and he didn't answer any of these very well, and just kind of showed me that I needed to do more homework before I asked all these questions. But along the way, I got a little bit excited about what he was telling us, and invited him to come to Santa Barbara. I could do that. At the time, I was director of the Institute of Religious Studies the University of California. I just gave that up a couple of months ago. And we oftentimes invite in good speakers to talk with students and townspeople about things that go on. We've had a series of good conferences there. And I thought it would really be wonderful to have this man, Brother Patrick, come in to Santa Barbara and talk about Thomas Merton. And my thought was, I'm not sure I can pay for this, but I think I can find the budget money someplace. Well, when I asked him to do that, very politely he said he didn't think he should. And then I went on to tell him how, in effect, how wonderful he was and how valuable this would be for all of us. And he responded that, he said that Father Louis, which is the name that Thomas Merton had in the monastery, left the monastery one time and didn't return. He said he thought that was a good lesson for the rest of them, that they ought to stay there. And then he went on to say that the abbot probably wouldn't want him to go. And I kept offering these things and saying, oh, no, we could write a letter to the abbot. And he still, resisted. And then he said he wasn't a public speaker. I said, that isn't any problem. We don't have to give a speech. We'll just gather some folks together in a room, and we'll have what we call a dialogue. They can ask you some questions. And finally, he got a little tough with me. And he said that his vocation was to be a monk. And he said that what the world doesn't need is to have a lot of monks running around the country, talking about Thomas Merton. And he said that Father Louis wouldn't like it. Father Louis didn't want people running around talking about Father Louis. But then at that point, I realized that I had overstepped a little bit, and I wanted to retreat and sort of apologize for, bad manners, because I could tell he didn't like this invitation. And he really didn't want to say no, but he had to say no. But I wanted to find out why he was resisting this way. So I asked him, this conversation went on for quite a while, and I'm summarizing it here sort of briefly, but I asked him, in effect, how he as a monk, knowing all the things that he knew, how he could allow himself to stay behind the walls of that cloister and not go out, and tell the truth if he thinks he has the truth. I didn't put it quite like that. I said that you know more than any other human being about Thomas Merton, and the world would like to know more about Thomas Merton. He's a very important 20th century figure, very important human being. One of the most important human beings that has ever been born, I would guess. And you know more than anybody else, and still you resist the invitation to talk about Thomas Merton. And his response was only that I am called to be a monk, I'm called to be a monk. So I apologized, we went our way, drove across country, got out to California. The very first telephone call was from a professor of religious studies in some other city in the Midwest who had program ideas. He was thinking about a wonderful program that the Institute of Religious Studies could sponsor. And he had called me, he had waiting for me to return to suggest that we do this thing. And I was still kind of thinking about Brother Patrick. So I said to him over the telephone, I call him Dave, but his name wasn't Dave, why would we want to do this? Why do we want to do this, I said. And his response was, well, to gain visibility. To gain visibility. And the contrast between those two incidents just became very, dramatic for me. Here, in the first place, was a man who knew a great deal, who had learned the secrets. The other day we were talking about mysteries that can be trusted. Here was a man who had access to a mystery that could be trusted, or a series of mysteries that could be trusted, who didn't feel the compulsion to go out and announce that, or to sell it, or to broadcast it, or to disseminate it. And then on the other hand, we had somebody who was trying to do something deliberately to capture visibility, to make something visible. Well, we ended up not getting Brother Patrick and doing the second program, and I guess it was a good one, but I can't remember quite how it went. In reflecting on that through the years since that time, I've been wondering if there isn't a sort of larger truth that that is at stake there. There was a time when visibility and invisibility were so carefully interlocked that you couldn't have one without the other. We talked about that yesterday, I think it was, or maybe the day before, where the visible world was understood to be a reflection of the invisible world, where everything visible pointed beyond itself for the meaning that it had, where meaning was always multiple, where things didn't simply mean what they appeared to mean, but they meant that plus other things. They had symbolic value. Now, somehow, during the Enlightenment period, and as we entered the modern period, we gave up, you know, we meaning humankind, gave up the invisible world. See, not all of us have done that, but secularization certainly has gone that way. We've abandoned the invisible world in order to, as we have said during that period, to get a firmer hold on the world of visibility, on this world. We don't need the other world, that world wherever it is, you know, beyond the stars or heaven or the eternal world, in order to have this world. We can simply love this world for its own sake, some have said. But it seems that perhaps the end result of that is that we've also lost visibility. We have to snatch at visibility. We have to do things to make ourselves visible. And I cite that story today because I think it gives us some kind of access into the monastic viewpoint. Now, the monastic viewpoint, as I view it, is primarily an alternative way of being. I don't think it's very different in character or intention from the character and intention of Holden Village. That is, it's there to provide a contrast to a more dominant or maybe majority kind of opinion way of living things, to provide an alternative to something else that is more prevalent. And one of the things that is attractive about it is its remoteness, is that it does stand in contrast to something else. Let me just add one story, and then I'll say a few more things, and I'll give you a chance to respond. One of my good friends, Jerry Needleman, who works out of University of San Francisco, has written a couple of good books on the new religions, went to Europe a couple of summers ago with a very kind of simple-minded question. He went from monastery to monastery, convent to convent, wherever he could go, paid his own way, had up 6 weeks for this, I guess it was. And it would sound odd, but it's the kind of thing a professor will do. He went around and asked the question, what relationship is there between sacred tradition, the sacred religious traditions of the West, and present human need? But he didn't say it quite that way. That's the way he wrote about it. But he would ask questions of the monks, what relationship is there between the monastic viewpoint and the kinds of issues that somebody would come across after having lived in San Francisco for quite a while, where Jerry Needleman lives? And he said he was disappointed throughout most of that trip because he couldn't make the connections. He got to Rome and he met a nun who listened to him for a while and told him that at some future point on his journey he would be surprised. And that's all he had to go on. He'd be surprised. He didn't know what it was going to be. Well, he went to Mount Athos, which is about as fine a place as you can go to. I'm going to be doing this in a couple of weeks, or starting next week, but not going all the way to Athos, but doing the same kind of thing, I guess. And he went to the to this monastery at the top of the mountain and knocked on the door, this big door, this Mount Athos. And the door opened, and the door always opens slowly, and you have to wait a long time for someone to come to answer the door. And he announced that he was Jerry Needleman from San Francisco, who had come to inquire of the abbot about the relationship between sacred tradition and present need. And before he could even get that sentence out, they closed the door on him. And he was standing there, and he said, standing there in his San Francisco clothes, and it started to rain. And he realized how kind of ridiculous this whole thing was. He was speaking English to someone that he came to understand, probably didn't even understand English, and he was talking about what he had brought his own agenda with him, what he wanted to find out from them, and he just thought he could do it by talking to a monk through the doorway on the top of this mountain near Greece. So he did an about-face, didn't know what else to do. That was the end of his journey. He started down the mountain, but the rain was so heavy that he got under a tree to shelter himself from the rain. And he said he started to cry. He couldn't tell if it was tears or rain, just the whole thing had come apart for him. And somebody, it was like the story of St. Augustine, where there was a voice that comes out of the bush that says, take up and read, or, you know, what are you doing here? Some voice said to him, What is the matter? And it turned out that a medical student who was studying in London, but who was Greek, had seen some of this and standing under a tree nearby and watching Needleman kind of scurry down the hill to get under that tree. And this man could speak both English and Greek, and in about an hour's time, he was in the monastery. This fellow helped him get in there, and he had an interview with the abbot. He writes about this in the book called Sacred Tradition and Present Need. It's an excellent book, I think. And he was up in the tower in the monastery asking the abbot all of these questions. Now, Needleman is of Jewish background, and very sympathetic to the Christian orientation. But he writes in this book that he never really has had faith. He said he found himself talking to this abbot, just wishing that he could believe, just wanting so badly to believe. And he was searching for it and striving for it, and he was wishing the abbot could help him. And he kept, you know, asking the abbot, pleading with the abbot to help bring this about for him. And he found out that the abbot wouldn't do it. The abbot wouldn't do it at all. And he got to he thought the end of the interview. I think it was around 2 a.m. He could see the moon outside the window. Apparently the clouds had passed and it was moon time. And he was keeping track. He's a very excellent writer. You know, he keeps track of how the moon passes and how the light in the room was at the time he was talking to this abbot. And he finally said to the abbot that wasn't enough. He wasn't delivering for him. And then the abbot delivered the true message to Needleman. He told Needleman that the genius of the monastic viewpoint was in its remoteness, See, if you could make it relevant, if it would resonate with everything in 20th century San Francisco society, then Needleman wouldn't go out seeking for it. It would become so common that it wouldn't be what it was. Now, there's a kind of paradox there, or a certain kind of irony, which is similar to the one of Brother Patrick Hart. I guess if you were Platonic on this, you would say the principle is that fine things run hard, and they're not commonly accessible. And that's a very difficult thing to admit if that's true, because most of us are sort of committed to the democratic process, and the truth is available to everybody. But the abbot was telling him, no, that's not the case. And that if the monk knows, he says, what he could do to make that message relevant, make it contemporary, but they won't do it, and they shouldn't do it, because if they were to take that step, they would destroy the very kernel of that which they have to offer to the world. Now, I want to go a little further with that, because you could never give a talk on this kind of thing and leave it there, because, you know, because we'd all feel like Needleman. We'd say, well, that's okay, that's for you guys over there, and we're out here, and we're clods or something. We're not quite capable of, I mean, we're second-class citizens, religiously speaking, and you're all, you're doing it, you know, in the most, in the proper way, and we're just getting it partially or something like that. And I don't want to leave it quite like that, because I'm not satisfied with that, and I'm not sure that that's the way it is. I've tried to push this kind of issue a little further, and I come out on it at this time, even though my thoughts on this subject are still being formed. I come out in the following way, that what is distinctive about the monastic viewpoint is the sensitivity to what, this is a heavy sentence, but we'll break it down, the sensitivity to what Immanuel Kant referred to as forms of intuition. That is, it's an intuitive viewpoint. It's based upon the cultivation of sensibilities rather than the cultivation of what the philosophers call ratiocination, you know, carefully, logically, rigorous reflection, thinking. Now, let's just leave those sentences the way they are, and I'll give the examples that I think will make them work. The monastic viewpoint is very, very dependent upon hearing and seeing. See, less upon thinking than upon hearing and seeing. And that's what I mean by forms of intuition, ways of intuiting things. And one of the most dominant characteristics or components of the monastic viewpoint is silence. You know, they make great use of silence. We talked yesterday about the great silence that occurs from the time after Vespers until after breakfast in the morning, and that's characteristic of all monasteries. There's no talking. There can be little. You can talk at breakfast, say things like pass the salt or something of that kind, but you don't engage in conversation, don't engage in dialogue or discussion. Now there's strategy involved in this. I used to think that things were really happening when there was sound. When you had sound, you had occurrences. The monks will say that that a lot of things happen in the silence. They say it more eloquently than that. They can say that silence is full of content. Silence is full of content. Silence is the time that memory works best. Memory is difficult to make work if you're bombarded by sounds. They'll go on, and they'll even say things like the world is created out of silence. Now, you can take that in an individual or a personal sense, and you can say that, I'm just trying to make sense of that statement, the world is created out of silence. You can say that there's hardly an event that occurs in anyone's life that can be explained simply in terms of the time span that was taken up by the event itself. You know, there'll be an occurrence, something will happen to you, and you don't catch the full significance of it until you reflect on it, until you kind of turn it over in your mind. People will say something to you, or to me, and we can't understand the significance of those words until we have a chance to turn it over in our minds, or to reflect on it, or to muse on it, or to contemplate it, and that's the right word, to contemplate. And then when you contemplate on those words become much larger and have much larger significance, become more extensive, their application is more extensive than they are the first time the event occurs. I always think about my own stuff here, but I think about things my mother said to me that didn't make complete sense at the time, but as in a situation of silence, when those words come back, they have added significance because they work. They are working, you know, subconsciously or unconsciously, but you need the silent time in order to catch the significance of words like that. Now, the monks will say then, the monastic viewpoint says, that the world is formed out of silence. The world is given formation out of silence. Silence is full of content. There's another thing that another you know, kind of extension of that point of view that is probably an Augustinian extension coming from the writings of St. Augustine. Augustine, I have to paraphrase this now, I can't quote him on it, but Augustine would say that meaning is to be found in the silence. Meaning is found in the silence, not when the sound is occurring, but after the sound has ceased. And there's a very fine scholar at Yale who's worked on this and has worked with sentences. And he says that, you know, before you can say a sentence, before you can set those sounds in motion, you need to have a thought. And the thought occurs in the silence. You have to have a thought. Some people can start talking before they have anything to say, but in fact, some of the best speakers are ones I think who can. Some people can say everything they can think. I'm not able to say everything I can think. And I think some people can say a lot more than they can think. A lot of disc jockeys can, I think, even talk when they're asleep. You know, just kind of keep talking on and on. But according to this Augustinian viewpoint, you need to have silence before, when the thought is being conceived, and then as the thought is being enunciated, there is sound. And then you get just the first thought in silence, and then a series of sounds all along the way. Those are words or syllables. But then you have to have a certain rhythm, a certain pattern to the sound. And when you get to the end of the sound, there is full stop, you know, period, and then it's silent again. And not until you get to the end of the series of sounds do you have the expression of the thought. So truth, then, both, you know, in prior to the speaking of the sentence and after the sentence is said, truth is to be found in the silence. Now, according to this Augustinian viewpoint, you can say that truth is retrospective. Now, we're getting into some big stuff here, because you say truth is retrospective, you're saying that not till you get to the end of the series do you understand the meaning of the sounds. See, not until the whole sentence is said and you've come to the silent point do you understand the relationship between the sounds along the way. Now, you can really wax eloquent on that if you'd like to. If I were a preacher, I could go to town on this, because you could say that's the way it is in the world. You know, first of all, there was silence before anything happened. Then there were events, and the events made a sound, they made impact, they registered. But you and I, as human beings, we're caught somewhere within the midst of that series of events. We're still in the time of creation, when the sounds are being uttered, and we're not to the end point yet. And not until we get to the end will we be able to understand the meaning of the series, because not until you get to the end do you get to the silence again, and it's only in the silence that the truth is to be found, because the truth is retrospective, always points back to the beginning. Well, now, I'm suggesting this as, I made three moves here today, I think. First of all, the suggestion was that the monastic viewpoint is relevant because of its irrelevance, because it stands in some kind of sharp contrast to a more common way of viewing things. That was the first suggestion. The second suggestion is that the way the contrast is built comes out of the use of forms of intuition. And you don't have to say rather than forms of reflection, but if you want to say that, it's okay to do it. But forms of intuition are a certain kind of reflection. And then I've given an example of silence, of dealing with no sound and sound as providing a clue as to the way in which the monk finds, or the monastic viewpoint finds, reality to be accessible. I want to do one more thing with this silence before we move on. Martin Luther, who was a monk until he gave it up to marry a nun, said that faith comes by hearing. Fides ex auditu. Faith comes by hearing. Now, I know when I was, you know, trained as a boy in Lutheran Sunday schools, I heard that, faith comes by hearing, but the emphasis was upon hearing the word. Unless the word is spoken, nobody can hear it, and unless you can hear the word, you can't have faith, because faith comes by hearing the word of God, and the word of God needs to be preached. Now, that's true. I mean, Luther believed that. You find all kinds of evidence that Luther believed that. But I've been lately now, because I have the sort of privileged luxury of doing this, I've been trying to think about what Luther would look like if we really see him as a monk. You know, rather than looking back at Luther from our point of view and seeing Luther in terms of what Luther did for Lutheranism, if we look at it from the other side, look at Luther as an Augustinian monk, as somebody who lived in the monastery, whose religious life was formed by those kind of spiritual disciplines, how then does he look? And it seems, you know, maybe not obvious, maybe not sure, but possible, that when Luther said, faith comes by hearing, he was invoking that attitude toward silence that I've just been talking about. What I'm suggesting is this, it's a little bit of a digression, but the reason we get tired at the end of the day is because our brains are doing several things simultaneously. See, we're gathering things in, and we're sorting out the things that we're gathering in all the time, but we're also closing a lot of things out. There are a lot of things you don't want to hear. The monks have a word for this, or a phrase. for this latter activity, they refer to it as tail-bearing. They train the ear not to hear certain things if they can. They don't want to hear certain things. You go down to Lafayette, Oregon, and you go into the place where they do the bookbinding, you see all these people with, you know, earphones on, and I thought maybe they're listening to stereophonic music, or if they're around Los Angeles, they'd be listening to KNX News. A lot of people jog and put those earphones on. But they're not doing that. They're doing that to close out the sounds because they don't want to hear certain sounds, because sounds will break the silence. So tale-bearing refers to gossip or rumor about anybody else. And they train the ear not to hear those kinds of things. You know, somebody comes up to you and has a little story to tell about somebody else, which is pejorative or negative. Well, the monks are committed, whether they do it or not, I don't know. They're committed to the view that they're not to tell that. They're not to allow that sound to be transmitted any further, because they know that sounds, as they are transmitted, they grow, they expand. And that's a kind of negative sound. And if the world is formed out of sounds like that, it's a negative world that is formed. Okay, now back to Luther. Luther says, fides ex auditu, faith comes by hearing. What I think may have been happening there is that Luther was listening to all kinds of sounds. See, all sorts of sounds bombard the ear, and you have to discern the sounds that bring life. Discern the sounds that are life-giving, life-inspiring. And not all sounds do that. So you listen. But as you listen for those sounds, you also close out certain other sounds. Faith comes by hearing, then, is, one way of talking about faith coming by hearing would be to get back to the monastic idea, the viewpoint, that silence is full of content, but that content is contrary, and it's necessary to discern the words that bring life from the words that do not. At least that's plausible. And it may be that he's talking about, you know, forms of intuition, ways of hearing, ways of seeing, as much as he's talking about the doctrine of the word. And we don't have to play the one thing down, you know, say he's not talking about the doctrine of the word, but he's also talking about hearing, and not just about faith, not just about word, but also about hearing. The same thing is true with seeing. The monastic viewpoint has a lot to do with the training of eyes. I've got more on this than I can do in a hurry, but one of the things that I like to do when I go into a monastery is study the eyes of the people who are there. And you look at those eyes, and I'm still not sure what to say about those eyes. Oftentimes the eyes will look at the floor. You know, you look at the person, you don't get any kind of signal back. The place where we got the most vivid signals back, the places where you get the most vivid signals back are in the women's monasteries, somehow. And I think that's I don't think that's because it's male-female things that are going on there as much as that they're probably further advanced than the males. I know why they're further advanced, because the masculine way of being religious requires some kind of mediation, because it's agential, first of all. And the feminine way is, the relationship is much more direct. I first thought of that when we were Lois and I were in a Trappistine monastery, and these ladies, women, were there waiting for the early service to begin, for the Mass to begin, and they had to wait for the priest to come in and say Mass for them. There was nobody there who could say Mass. Well, the priest was, he was a nice fellow and all that, but it wouldn't be the kind of job that I would enjoy, being the one priest in a Trappistine abbey. And he had to live off some distance from the abbey, and he had a dog. And he brought this dog in, and the dog was a little bit like our dog, somewhat out of control. And the dog followed him into the chapel, and he had to go back and close the door. Then one of the women came in late, and the door opened again, and the dog came back in, and they had to fiddle around with this dog. And I don't think it was because of that, but just because it seemed to me that they had something very strong going there on their own, and to have to wait for the priest to say Mass seemed to me to be ludicrous, not ludicrous, redundant. They didn't need that kind of mediation. There was a relationship with the heart of things that was much more direct because of the nature of woman than they could get out of that kind of priestly mediation. Let's see, I lost the train of thought on that one. Well, back on the thing about seeing and about eyes. Monks' eyes seem to be gentle eyes, probably, youthful eyes. Oftentimes the eyes look a lot younger than the body, boyish eyes at times. At any rate, all I wanted to say about that is that I think about eyes a lot when I'm in the monasteries. And you get an awful lot of the meaning of the thing by watching how the eyes go. The abbot will look at somebody and that person will do something. And there are signals that are passed because they have to develop, you know, kind of sign language with the eyes in the silence, because they're not talking. They're giving signals with the eyes. Now, I've just been wondering about what kind of, you know, what sort of world does the monk see? And you don't have to rely on your own intuitions on this. You can look in the literature. And there are two dominant images in the monastic literature. There's the image of the watchman who is waiting for the morning. That's very, very strong. You know, my soul waits for the Lord more than they that wait, more than the watchman who waits for the morning. And I've felt, and I've, in fact I've tested this by asking him about this, I felt that these monks, you know, are really expecting that something is going to happen. In fact, I think the reason, if you can give a reason, the reason that they are willing to take the vows of poverty, celibacy, and obedience, it's somewhat selfish in a way. That's a paradoxical thing to say, that they're abandoning all things for selfish purposes. But in a way, it is selfish, because they're betting on something else. You know, they're saying that this is not all there is. This life that we have now is not all there is. And they're not. Some of them are caught on works righteousness, but I would say the majority are not. They're not saying that if they do this in this life, they will earn the right, you know, to enjoy eternal life in the next world. But they're saying that if that's the way it is, if there is a unum necessarium, a one thing necessary, then it behooves us to prepare ourselves for that. That is, if this world is a reflection of a world that is yet to be, it is necessary to prepare oneself for that world that is next to be, the world that is to come. And it's like the watchman waiting for the morning. They get up and they think, well, is today the day? I don't know if they say that, but you know, something is going to happen, and that something is going to be so wonderful, so fine, that we just don't want to risk missing it, like the watchman waiting for the morning. I heard a monk talk that way. It isn't only monks who talk this way, but I just happened to hear a monk who went into the hospital because he had a tumor, and they thought it was cancerous. Apparently, it wasn't. Oh, I'm not sure about that. And when I saw him after this had happened, I said to him, "It looks like you've lost some weight." You know, I just said that as a not the brightest thing in the world to say, but it's a way to get a little something going. And he said. He said he had, and then he told me what had happened to him. He'd been in the hospital 10 days. I said, he said, and they thought it was cancer. And I said, gee, that sounds pretty scary. He says, scary? He says, I was excited. I said, excited? He said, yes, I thought I was going to be there soon. Now, I know this man well enough to know that he literally believes that. He was getting excited because the next thing was going to be better than this, and he thought he was going to be there. Be there soon. That's one of the images that is part of the perceptual equipment that this monastic viewpoint sort of works through. But there's another one that for me is more glorious, and that's the image of the cosmic wedding. These people, this kind of medieval monastic viewpoint, mystical viewpoint, understands that that's something that things as they are now are not the way things are meant to be. There are things unfinished. There are things deficient in this life. There's suffering. There's illness. There's sin. There's all these negative things. And they believe that, and I think the dominant theme in that regard is that things are not yet unified. They are at odds with each other. There's conflict, there's paradox, there's irony. There are things that occur that do not form any kind of coherence. But they're looking ahead, as I understand them, to a time when there will be, they refer to it as a glorious wedding of heaven and earth, glorious wedding of heaven and earth, when all things will be one, when there won't be any kind of gap between the way things are and the way things ought to be. And then they can talk about when the bridegroom will appear to meet the bride, and when heaven and earth will be at one, and when Ernesto Cardinal talks about this grand choral chant that will be occurring, when the kind of melodies that we carry in our own hearts will be in the same key as the melodies that the angels are singing, and that will be the grand day. Well, I'm suggesting by all of this that there's very much of a future cast to the monastic viewpoint. It isn't just, I don't want to say what it isn't. It's a future cast. Well, the final thing I want to say in this regard has no bearing upon what we said so far, but I just think at some point it needs to be included in the conversation. For every kind of theological viewpoint or kind of religious way of looking at life, there are terms and categories and definitions that become appropriate. And out of this monastic viewpoint is a definition of God, a description of God, which I think is really valuable. Now, if we had the time, we could talk about all the different ways that Christians have found to describe the nature of the God they worship. And you can talk about God as creator and God as the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. You can talk about God as Trinity and a host of ways of doing that. But the attitude toward the way that God is depicted in the monastic viewpoint, the way that he's depicted primarily, comes in the words of Augustine in Augustine's Confessions, where Augustine asks the question, who is it who made me? And he goes all around and he asks all these things. You know, he asks the stars, did you make me? The star says, no, we were made. The planets, did you make me? No. Animals, what is God like? And all these things respond that he is the one who made us. He is the creator. But then he goes on to say, you know, after he's worked this through, he goes on to say, and the bottom line, to use Joe Barnes' phrase from yesterday, bottom line is that God is the life of my soul. The life of the life of my soul. And the picture there is of a soul that is being animated by a vital principle. We know that when that happens in people, they're really animated. But God is the life force of the life force of the soul. Or let me just say it the way that Augustine did, the life of the life of my soul. And that means, would mean then that that self-knowledge is the pathway to knowledge of God. Turn it around, you can almost say that unless one knows oneself well, one cannot know God well. And that's why it has to be silent, why there has to be time for reflection, why the spiritual strategies focus on contemplation, upon the use of time, the use of space. I think I've said enough today to almost used up all the time, but if anyone wants to respond to.
What hasn't become clear to me is is what role the community, why not be a hermit?
Well, some are hermits.
Is the community part of the monastic viewpoint, the community of the monks?
Well, the community, the word community is, I mean, community has reference to the word community, which is close to the word communion, which includes the word union. Now this, I've been referring to this as a point of view because I'm used to talking to students in a state university situation where you call everything a kind of point of view or notion or whether you believe in it or not. But this point of view focuses very heavily on patterns of union or unitive things. It finds its examples in relationship between male and female. It loves that example. The relationship between God and the soul can be likened to the relationship between a man and a woman who love each other. That's one example of union. The example of unity, another example is one I cited today, silence. There is unity in the silence. I'm coming around to this, but unity in the silence. You know, some people love to wake up early in the morning and be outdoors by themselves before things get messed up, they'll say, or before anything happens. Get out there early, you know, when there's still a kind of unity to it all, because by the end of the day it gets fragmented and it's difficult to put it back. Now, another example of unity, well, there's cosmic unity and there's natural unity. They love the unity of the seasons and the unity of the stars, the planets. You see them looking at stars and noting, there are a lot of stargazers among the monks. But the community also is an example of unity. They wish that the community itself, maybe as a church or as a congregation could be a symbol of unity. That's part of the idea. The other part of the idea is that it provides support. They know that an individual can't do this on your own. It isn't just a private way of being. You need to have mirrors, for one thing. You need to have people who are suggesting to you what you were like, and you need to be forgiven, and you need to have somebody around who can mediate that forgiveness to you. And a lot of good reasons for community, but there are some who become hermits. Now, Thomas Merton became the only hermit at Gethsemane Monastery, and that was primarily because he was asked to write. He needed to get off by himself. His vocation was to write. That's almost a pity, because he wrote far too much, I think. A lot of what he wrote, he didn't write very well. A lot of it he did write really well, but a lot of it is kind of first draft. But that was his vocation, to write. He became a hermit. And there are some who really feel called to the solitary way of life, the hermit way of life. And then there are even some who become, you know, super hermits, who go off into the woods someplace and only come down like for Easter celebrations or at Christmas time. If you're around California at all, there's a hermitage where all the monks are hermits. They all live in the individual cells in the Big Sur area, right south of Esalen, right in their little town called Lucia. Some of you know where that is. There's a little sign, a little cross on the side of the road that says Immaculate Heart Hermitage. And if you follow this thing up the hill, there's a group of about 20 men or so who are living the hermit life. They only get together for worship services and on Sunday for dinner. The rest of the time they're in their cells. Well, they work together, and on Wednesday afternoons they go to the beach. But the rest of the time they're living the kind of solitary life. Anybody else?
From yesterday, I didn't get asked. You were talking about a single dominating theme permeating an age, mm-hmm. defining an age. What would you say the single dominating theme is of this age?
Well, that's a good question, but I think it has to do with viewing things through a problem-solving mentality, taking life to be a problem, working at life, making, if image is the theme for medieval times, I think problem is the primary theme for our time. And we've solved so many problems, it has worked so well for us. You know, thinking about life in the last century and a half, we've done so well with looking at life as problems, consisting of a series of problems to be solved, that there's a good reason for that domination of our way of life. And yet, but it also seems that we've come to the point where, the reason that this contemplative viewpoint is coming back into vogue again is because of dissatisfaction with problem solving. That's an awfully difficult one for me to think about, because the problems are not solved. We've still got the problems of the 60s, the problems of the 70s. They have not been solved, but I don't know. I sometimes think that you don't get solutions to problems, but somehow you get past them. And that's you can very easily cop out if you take this kind of attitude. And that's you came right to the, to the heart of what I'm struggling with at the moment, because I'm not sure. You know, I think I can explain why the contemplative point of view has come into prominence again. I think I know pretty well why that happened. I'm not so sure that I approve of it, because I think it's a kind of a specialized religious point of view. I mean, I like it, and on the other hand, I worry about it, just because of this thing about problems. We get onto this before the problems are solved, but in addition, I think we're trying to find humankind, trying to find an alternative way of mediating life or relating to reality than the way which is defined by problem solving. And I've been influenced so much by a book by Henry Aaron that I was thinking I shouldn't even be talking these days because I'm confused on the end point. But Henry Aaron says that we were just that close, he says, to being able to solve the problem of poverty in this country. And then something happened. And what happened was that the simple faiths that were part, you know, were incorporated in the great society, in the aspirations of the great society, turned out upon analytical reflection not to be very sound. And when we thought about those things, we started second-guessing those things. And as a result, you've got a society confused now. He blames it on the professors in large part. You know, the critical temper is what he calls it. When the critical temper went to work on the simple faiths, it found flaws there. And when it reported the flaws, diagnosed those flaws, it stopped the process. It stopped the process of, you know, trying of solving the problems. I was going to talk about the Vietnam War today, but I have to get myself worked up to that because that's such a heavy one. But sometimes I think that the United States created the war. That's a wild thing to say, but that the war, you know, the war is a symbol of our frustration, because the war was not fought only on Asian battlefields, but the greater part of the war was fought in America. A mental war, the anguish that came about when a society is at odds with itself. And sometimes I think that when that kind of being at odds with oneself becomes so strong and so big, so large, that it almost becomes externalized. And in fact, it does become externalized. And it may have become externalized in the pressure that was put, the freight that was put onto the Vietnam situation. That may not have had to have been such a big thing, except that it was not only, you know, our involvement in Southeast Asia, but all of the confusions of the society were somehow inserted into that event too. And, well, anyway, back to Henry Aaron. It's the critical temper, criticism, problem solving, treating life as problem, that has just about run its ground. There's a new book by John Gardner, which is, I don't like the book too much, but I know that the topic is, as we say, right on. The title is Morale. And Gardner says that, you know, 10 years ago, he was the author the sponsor of a group, Common Cause, cause-dominated, identifying issues, trying to muster, you know, inspiration, support, information, resources to do something about these causes. Now he's had a turnabout. He writes autobiographically. He's had a turnabout. And in effect, he says, you know, that the society has become so adept at criticism, at ferreting out problems and identifying these things as issues, that the society is in a state of paralysis. And what we need at the moment is for somebody or some group or maybe the society at large to put the pieces back together again. And we've lost the unity, we've lost the cohesion. The book that the library has over here that I picked up last night is entitled In Search of the American Dream. And we don't have the American Dream any longer. And I think that one of the reasons that the monastic viewpoint has become intriguing again is that it offers an alternative to the problem solving. My goodness. To the problem.
Yeah. Chair all right?
It offers an alternative to the problem-solving way of going about things. And it's still an open question to me whether we should approve of that or find that to be lack of courage. Solzhenitsyn is on one side, and you've got John Gardner on the other, and I think that's, Walter Cronkite says that's the way it is at the moment.
Maybe problem-solving by committee is rather than problem-solving by the individual.
Morris Mitchell at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions is bugged on this one, too, and he says that the problem is that the problem is us. You know, the people who are out there trying to solve the problems are the problem, and you
know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow we'll do this or something else again. Thank you.